Hello, I'm Jeffrey Moat, CEO of Pallium Canada. I am thrilled to invite you to join us virtually at the world's largest palliative care echo session on October 18th at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time. This exciting, history-in-the-making event will bring together thousands of healthcare professionals from around the globe with a panel of internationally renowned palliative care experts to explore innovative approaches and best practices in primary palliative care. Simultaneous live interpretation will be available in French, Mandarin, Hindi, Spanish, Brazilian Portuguese, and Arabic to make this a truly global experience. Don't miss your chance to be part of a global palliative care movement on October 18th. Register today at echopalliative.com. I'll see you there.
Hello and welcome to the Palliative Care Journal Watch podcast by Pallium Canada for September 2024, where our panel of palliative care experts keeps you informed of the latest peer-reviewed palliative care literature. Our hosts, Dr. Leonie Herks and Dr. Sharon Watanabe, join us for the 14th episode of the Palliative Care Journal Watch. If you'd like to access accompanying slides and links to the articles discussed in today's podcast, visit the link in the episode notes. This podcast is a collaboration between Pallium Canada and the divisions of palliative care at Queen's University, McMaster University, McGill University, University of Toronto, University of Manitoba, University of Calgary, University of Alberta, and the Hadassah Hebrew University Medical Center in Israel. It is a part of the Palliative Care ECHO Project, which aims to support continuous professional development among healthcare providers across Canada who care for patients with life-limiting illness. The Palliative Care ECHO Project is supported by financial contributions from Health Canada. However, the views expressed in today's episode do not necessarily represent the views of Health Canada. With no further ado, it's time for the Journal Watch.
Welcome to our 14th episode of the Palliative Care Journal Watch. My name is Dr. Leonie Herks, and today we'll be joined by my co-host, Dr. Sharon Watanabe, along with guest panelists, Dr. Ayngaran Sinaraja, Dr. Jean Matthews, and Dr. Anna Work. The Palliative Care Journal Watch is a regular series of webinars that keeps you up to date on the latest peer-reviewed palliative care literature. This program is led by experts from several divisions of palliative care medicine across Canada and internationally. Our team of academic clinicians is on the lookout. We regularly monitor over 30 journals and highlight papers that have the potential to challenge us to think differently about a topic or confirm our current practices. This program is part of the Palliative Care ECHO Project, which is supported by a financial contribution from Health Canada. This project aims to cultivate communities of practice and establish continuous professional development amongst healthcare providers across Canada who care for patients with life-limiting illnesses. We invite you to visit our website at www.echopalliative.com, where you can learn more and check out our upcoming ECHO sessions that cover a variety of palliative care-related topics. In terms of what to expect from today's session, we will highlight and discuss our top four article selections and provide a list of honorable mentions at the end. The honorable mentions are articles that we thought were noteworthy, but due to time constraints, we weren't able to discuss them today. I'm Leonie Herks, and I'll be co-hosting today's session. I'm currently Section Chief of Pediatric Palliative Medicine in Calgary with Alberta Health Services and a professor in the Cumming School of Medicine. I'll now ask Dr. Sharon Watanabe to introduce herself.
Good morning. I'm Sharon Watanabe. I'm Director of Palliative Care at the Cross Cancer Institute in Edmonton, and also professor of palliative care medicine at the University of Alberta.
Thanks, Sharon. And just to note that Dr. Jose Pereira is not able to join us today, I'd like to now ask Dr. Ayngaran Sinaraja to introduce himself.
I work out of Lake Richelt and Queen's University, where I work as a palliative care physician. Nice to be here.
Thank you. Dr. Jean Matthews.
Thanks, Dr. Herks. I'm an assistant professor in the Division of Palliative Medicine at Queen's University, and it's great to be here.
We're so glad to have you. And Dr. Anna Work.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. I am a palliative care physician based out of Edmonton. Nice to be with everyone.
Great. We have a wonderful panel today. I'm looking forward to the discussions. In terms of disclosures, Pallium Canada is a not-for-profit organization that has received funding from Health Canada. Aside from receiving funding from Health Canada, Pallium also generates funds through its course registration fees and the Pallium Pocketbook. All right, we have four featured articles, as I mentioned in the beginning. The first one is looking at factors associated with transitions to adult care amongst adolescents and young adults with medical complexity. Then we'll be looking at care coordination between family physicians and palliative care physicians for patients with cancer, results of a quality improvement initiative. Then novel therapies for nausea and vomiting and advanced illness and supportive cancer care. And then finally, looking at a randomized control trial of a nurse-led brief behavioral intervention for dyspnea in patients with advanced lung cancer. Quite a wonderful breadth and depth of articles. All right, so we'll move right on to our first featured article, Dr. Sinaraja.
Again, a pleasure to be here today. So I'm going to be talking about factors associated with transitions to adult care among adolescents and young adults with medical complexity, published this year in the American Journal of Hospice and Palliative Care. So adults with medical complexity are living longer due to medical advances, and therefore they will be transitioning to adult healthcare services. And it might be that the current transition care systems and policies are perhaps not fully recognizing the need of these adolescents with medical complexity and their families, and what social determinants of health might impact this. And so the goal of this paper was to look at the relationship between social determinants of health and transition care. This is out of the US, where they have the National Survey of Children's Health Data. So they looked at that cohort, a retrospective cohort. They focused on adolescents from 12 to 17 with medically complex health conditions. This is a representative survey, and so it is weighted to the composition of each state, where you start with 479 survey respondents, but with the weighting, you actually weighted to represent almost 450,000 adolescents. The main outcome was any support for transition to adult healthcare, and there are three survey components that goes into this. The three are time alone with provider without an adult during the last visit, provider actively working with adolescents to manage care transition, and then last but not least, the provider discussed a shift to adult health providers with adolescents specifically. And then they looked at the independent variables of social determinants of health, economic stability, neighborhood, physical environment, education, food, community, and healthcare system. And then they did statistical analysis. The key findings were that a lot of these adolescents do have a lot of needs. So 2/3 of the adolescents were in special education. Almost half missed more than 11 days of school. And this is a US sample. Again, 1/3 received some sort of food assistance. And 17% responded that they experienced some sort of hunger. And half had at least 2 adverse childhood experiences. So adolescents with medical complexity are also having these other high-risk social determinants of health. And the overall conclusion was that only 1/3 received any support from providers in their transition to adult care. And we look at some of the factors. Receiving special education was negatively related to transition support. And those who had hunger had greater odds. And they also looked at poverty level. Again, if you have lower income, parent with a college degree, and aggravated parents were negatively associated with providers actively managing the transition. So really, it shows that negative complex environments can impact how adolescents navigate and get into transitions to adult care. There is an important subset, perhaps with some problems with paying bills, food assistance, and food insecurity that might deserve some even more attention. Parent-provider relationships are also important to have those expectations. And perhaps provider assumptions impacts transition support. For example, parents with high education had actually less support. And is there an assumption that these parents already know how to do this properly? Whereas high aggravated parents, same thing, less support. And so is there a reluctance for the providers to engage and talk more? And so really, we need to incorporate not just how to transition, but also the social determinants of health. To me, I like this article because it is not a common area of experience for me, especially as an adult palliative care physician. We will be taking over adolescents and young adults coming into our service. And so we need to be mindful of these barriers, factors that impacts how they come over. I was introduced to the standardized approaches to transition conversations and processes that are out there and recommended by existing guidelines. So it'll be good to hear about and discuss that more, perhaps. And Dr. Hertz, you're on as well. You're an expert in this as well. So it'll be good to hear about that. And then the importance of poverty has been highlighted again. The strength is that it is a nationally representative data set. It is the US though. So in Canada, we'll have to talk through whether this applies to us. So I'm sure it does, what the caveats might be. It does have a comprehensive examination of a lot of social determinants of health. Limitations, again, it's a secondary use of the data set. It's cross-sectional, so one point only. And reporting bias can't be avoided. They asked the questions to reflect back on the past 12 months. So I'll stop there and turn it over to the panel.
Thanks, Angaran. Would any of our guest panelists like to share their thoughts?
I had a couple of thoughts related to this. One was, how do they define the population of AYA with medical complexity? And Angaran, how much do you think that maps into AYA with palliative care needs? And, you know, that's a moving kind of definition, whether we think about prognosis-based models versus need-based models. So I had a question about, you know, how much of this population that they surveyed do you think are the AYA patients that will come to a palliative care clinic? And then I had a question about clinic models that we already have existing for AYA palliative care, and, you know, what are kind of best practices around that in Canada? Thank you.
I need to look at the article to refresh my memory about how they defined the medical complexity. I'm fairly certain they looked at the diagnosis codes from the survey. Certainly, it's restricted to 12 to 17. It is a good question about the clinics and, you know, specific clinics that are focused on transitions. And maybe I'll actually turn this over to then Dr. Hooks, who, again, you're the one of the experts here. So if you probably know more about this area than I do.
Yeah, I think it's a very underserved area. And I know it's something we've talked about for many years. But, you know, as we all know, people with multimorbidity are living for longer, including children. And so I think we are going to see more adolescents moving into young adulthood who need ongoing palliative care support, who live with a high risk of death due to their complex medical conditions. And it is, I think, a somewhat separate population from the cancer population, which is where most of the AYA work has actually been focused. And so there, I would say there's a lot of work relatively being done in cancer care, but very little being done in conditions outside of that. And that's where actually most of these kids will be coming from a population base. So I think it's a challenge for us in adult palliative medicine to think about where would be the right home, because it's not the cancer clinic. Like, where is the opportunity then to be able to see ambulatory patients with this type of very complex medical complexity to be able to manage their transition needs? And I do think this article is very noteworthy for the part that it points out about all of those added layers of distress that these complex kids experience. It's not just the challenges of going from pediatric to adult care and the changes in continuity of care and is the expertise available within the adult world, but then all of these other things that we might not think about, those social determinants of health and family structures, which are impacted by children who live with these chronic conditions. And so becoming more versed in that, I think, is going to be a very big challenge for us. I don't have the solutions, and I don't know of any good models right now that I'm aware of outside of cancer. So hear anyone else's thoughts. I know we don't have a lot of time, but if anyone has any thoughts to share, that would be great. So Ben, Robert, I don't know if it's Robert or Robert, but that I found the transitions to be quite challenging. I think lots of food for thought and lots of opportunity for collaboration between the pediatric and adult palliative care programs. And hopefully we'll start working on that more robustly as a national group of colleagues. Thanks, everyone. Again, like, there's so many interesting things we could delve into in all of these articles. So we hope that this whets your appetite for further conversations in your own programs and maybe further interest in specific education around these topics in your programs. So we're going to move on to the next article by Dr. Matthews. I'll let you introduce it, Jean. Thanks.
Thanks, Dr. Hirsch. So I'm going to be presenting an article titled Care Coordination Between Family Physicians and Palliative Care Physicians for Patients with Cancer, Results of a Quality Improvement Initiative. This was published in JCO Oncology Practice earlier this year. So the problem that we were trying to address, so this was a study out of Queens, and I was the senior author on this study. We know that patients with cancer are followed by multiple specialists, and this can lead to fragmentation of care. Patients value having their family physicians involved to coordinate their care, but often patients, when they start getting treatment at the cancer center, can lose contact with their family physicians. One of the reasons for this, and particularly at our center, was that oncologists were directly referring patients to our oncology palliative care clinic without first consulting with the family physicians about, you know, their own capacity to provide primary palliative care and remain involved as the patient's medical home. For those who are not familiar, this is a vision put forth by the College of Family Physicians of Canada that the family physician serves as the medical home to coordinate care between multiple specialists and to provide longitudinal continuity of care. So Dr. Herx was involved in some of the early work with this project where we surveyed regional family physicians about their barriers to providing primary palliative care, and they identified that this lack of communication when oncologists were directly referring to the oncology palliative care clinic was a barrier to them providing care. So we wanted to implement a QI project to systematically facilitate care coordination between family physicians and palliative care physicians. We co-designed a coordination toolkit along with our family physician colleagues, which essentially is a four-page letter. The first page is an introduction to our team and how to contact us. Page two is various options for collaborative care, including ongoing consultative care with the specialist team, one-time consult, consult not needed because the family physician feels like they're able to meet the needs for palliative care for this patient. And the idea is the family physician kind of picks off the box that applies to them for collaborative care for this patient, and then sends that back to us in the clinic, and that determines our ongoing follow-up for this patient. So we implemented this as a QI project, and we measured the feasibility of sending out the letters, response rate to getting those collaborative care preferences back, and then a qualitative survey about the usefulness of the intervention. In terms of our key findings, we had a 90% feasibility rate of sending the letter over the 6-month implementation period where we were measuring these outcomes. We had a surprisingly good response rate of 86% of family physicians sending the note back to us to say how they want to collaborate for this patient's palliative care needs. Median response time of 3 to 4 days. About 80% of the family physicians indicated they would prefer the specialist palliative care team in the clinic to provide ongoing consultative care, whereas 20% said that either they could follow up after a one-time consult or a consult was not needed because they could currently meet the primary palliative care needs of the patient. And qualitative analysis revealed themes including appreciation for this coordination intervention, family physicians really owning their role as the patient's medical home, descriptions of barriers such as lack of time to practice palliative care or discomfort with the complexity of care, particularly with some symptom management. So we concluded that we were able to successfully implement a QI initiative to improve care coordination. And this is now standard of care at our oncology palliative care clinic. And we feel that this coordination toolkit can help not only protect the patient and family physician primary palliative care relationship, but also optimize specialist palliative care resource for those more complex patients. In terms of our strengths, I think our high response rate was one of the strengths. In terms of limitations, as this was a QI initiative, the generalizability and effectiveness of such a toolkit and what it'll look like in different health systems is not known. And then finally, we did not systematically survey the patient perspective on care coordination or measure any downstream effects on patient outcomes or healthcare utilization. And these are all things that we'd like to look at. So I'll end it there and I'll open it up for discussion.
Go for it, Sharon.
Yes. So I selected this paper in a wonderful work, very impressed with the uptake, you know, both on the palliative care clinician side and the family physician side. And it sounds like really was successful in improving that communication and coordination. One thing that struck me, and I hope that you can comment on, is the fact that almost 80% of family physicians express a preference for ongoing involvement of the consultative team. So I'm curious to know, and I also noticed that maybe I think 15% were not stage four. So I'm just wondering about the impact on the patient load in the clinic and how you're managing that.
Thanks, Dr. Watanabe. That's a good question. We were also struck by that 80% number. And I think that speaks to our intervention helped to improve care coordination, but it did not help to address capacity for family physicians to provide their own primary palliative care. And we know the barriers to that. You know, it can be time, it can be lack of education, it can be compensation models. You know, there are interventions that need to go along with care coordination to improve capacity for family physicians to also kind of provide their own primary palliative care. So I think that's an important point to take away from this. And yeah, this is a early palliative care clinic. So although the majority of our patients are stage 3 and 4, it does have implications for resource utilization because as the majority of family physicians choose ongoing consultative care, it does add to our resource burden. So that's something to consider as well.
Jean, great work with this. And it reminds me that two things. Family physicians are eager to coordinate care, I think, right? Like they are wanting to discuss with specialists. And I think that's why there was such a great uptake with them responding, even though it was sort of a 3 to 5 page document that they had to read through. It's similar to positive findings we found in Calgary as well, when oncologists sent a specific care coordination letter to family doctors. There was actually a great response from family doctors again to those letters. And to me, that's a positive. The second thing is, I think, to your question, Sharon, is that the workload implications might depend on where the palliative care team is starting from. A lot of places in Canada are starting from a place where we inadvertently take over and we are following these patients forever. And so this might allow us to actually not have 100% intake, but at least 10 or 20% can be, you know, the family doctors do want to get involved, and so we can give them back. Whereas I know that not every place, I know some places just have a purely consultative, and so that might need a different approach, I would think so.
And there's a great comment in the Q&A from Ben. I worry that as family physicians do fewer visits, that the confidence in their skill set will decrease. Is there any concern that the community family physicians will eventually stop doing palliative care as palliative care specialists become involved earlier, with sometimes a direct referral to palliative care? That, as we've all experienced, that's not coming, it's from oncology to palliative care, and so the family docs don't have a chance to be involved. They also wonder how to include non-cancer diagnoses. Is there any worry that 80% of family physicians do not provide palliative care? Any thoughts, Jean?
I think these are all big and important questions. I mean, I think the first step is to ask family physicians. You know, that's what we did with this intervention, was to, you know, as Angren mentioned, instead of directly oncology speaking to palliative care and us seeing the patients in clinic, we started asking family physicians, hey, do you want to be involved? Do you want to take over or do you want to kind of manage this primary palliative care? And I think that's the first step. But I think, as Ben mentioned, like, this is just the first step. We need to increase capacity, education for primary palliative care so that they maintain that skill set and are comfortable. And again, most of this work is done in cancer, and I think we need to think about what this will look like in non-cancer as well.
Thanks, Jean. Anna?
Yeah, I think it is important. And it's great that you do ask family physicians, because I think it also helps out that point where when people go to the cancer clinic, when they do not get further treatment at the cancer clinic, then they feel almost abandoned if they don't, you know, even though they have a family doctor, they haven't been kind of part of their care. And so this, I guess, gets them involved right at the get-go and allows them that opportunity to stay involved. So yeah, thanks for the great work.
Thanks, everyone. Lots more we could discuss for sure, but we'll move on to our next article, which is looking at novel therapies for nausea and vomiting and advanced illness and supportive cancer care. Over to you, Anna.
Great, thank you. Yes, so this article was a review article done by Dr. Meller Davis, and it was published in the Palliative Care and Social Practice earlier in June of this year. So in the introduction, some of the key points that they remind us is that nausea and vomiting is a very common symptom, and the prevalence ranges between 40 to 60%. We use serotonin receptor blockers frequently, but they have little proven benefit in treating nausea associated with advanced cancer. Mechanisms that generate nausea and vomiting are poorly understood, even though we look at the pathophysiology and then we try to make recommendations for antiemetics that are based on presumed causes of nausea and vomiting. So this review article looked at three medications that have antiemetic benefits, either in controlling chronic nausea and vomiting, and those are brilnansirin and mirtazapine, or treating acute and breakthrough nausea, which is isopropyl alcohol. So we'll look at these in turn. And the first one was brilnansirin, which is an atypical antipsychotic with high affinity for dopamine and serotonin receptors. It's approved for treatment of schizophrenia in Japan, Korea, and China. And there are few studies done, but one retrospective study reported that a transdermal patch of 20 to 40 milligrams daily improved nausea that was not responding to prednisone and prochlorperazine. So that's the only one that it really talked about specifically about nausea, but it mentioned some other studies that suggest possible decrease in the risk of delirium. Some of the advantages of using this are less risk of extrapyramidal symptoms. Because it's a patch, you can actually, you know, use it if you don't have an oral route, and would reduce the risk of drug interactions within the GI tract. There may be a lower risk of prolonging the QTC interval compared to haloperidol, and then it may not reduce seizure thresholds as much as some of the other antipsychotics. So in summary, from this medication, there may be a role in treating nausea, vomiting in advanced cancer, but more randomized trials using standard antiemetics like haloperidol or metoclopramide as active controls are needed. So the next medication that they talked about was mirtazapine, which is a noradrenergic and specific serotonergic antidepressant that can treat symptoms other than depression. It looked at 7 studies, but they were mainly prospective and single arm. And these ones suggested benefits of mirtazapine on symptoms related to advanced cancer, namely nausea, depression, sleep, and appetite. But then when you looked at some of the fewer randomized control trials that centered around GI symptoms, mainly nausea, vomiting, and appetite, these were negative. So this suggests a robust placebo effect, which may affect the observed mirtazapine benefits that were seen in the single arm prospective and retrospective studies. I think one of our Journal Watch topics was on one of these randomized trials previously, so you can have a listen to that. There are benefits as a prophylactic antiemetic in chemotherapy-induced nausea vomiting, and one study suggested possibly substituting it for olanzapine because it causes less drowsiness and better tolerated. And not so many studies really related specifically on nausea vomiting in advanced cancer, but more for prophylaxis. There has been improvement in nausea vomiting and pruritus associated with spinal morphine anesthesia, which can be used for cancer pain, and reduction in postoperative nausea vomiting and shivering. And then also some other effects that can reduce upper GI symptoms for patients with functional bowel syndromes and improving pruritus in patients who have cancer or uremia. So the bottom line is the mirtazapine can be beneficial in treating multiple cancer symptoms, but this needs to be explored in randomized trial before any further recommendations can be made. And then finally, they looked at isopropyl alcohol, which I thought this was quite interesting, actually. And most of the randomized trials are done in management of acute nausea vomiting in the emergency department and postoperative nausea vomiting. And there have been reports of other aromatherapy like peppermint or ginger to help with breakthrough nausea vomiting from chemotherapy, but nothing specific for IPA or isopropyl alcohol. The randomized trials do show that IPA or PrEP pads, you know, the alcohol swabs that used in the emergency department actually improve nausea vomiting and reduce the use of rescue antiemetics and reduce overall costs. And one study showed that it might have a greater pain reduction as well. And there is a rapid onset of improving the nausea after 2, 10, and 30 minutes. And then this article looked at a systematic review of the 3 mentioned randomized trials and showed actually there was no difference in the number of people who vomited between the isopropyl alcohol and the placebo groups. So this suggests that the IPA may be more effective in reducing nausea than preventing vomiting. And there's no data to suggest that it prevents postoperative nausea and vomiting, and controversial whether or not in post-op settings, it can actually reduce the need for antiemetics, just given the number of studies. And so the advantages to this is that it's inexpensive, so you can actually pull it out of your pocket. It's easy to administer. There are few drug reactions and adverse reactions and can be used as a bridge to treating acute nausea until you get the standard antiemetics that can take effect. And so it can also be self-administered as needed from home. I think this is a neat way of looking at some of the existing medications that we are using for nausea, vomiting. And I like to kind of think that, you know, we like to actually use what we have and use them in different ways rather than try to reinvent the wheel. And there are overlap of a lot of symptoms. So, you know, are we improving the depression and the insomnia that then improves the nausea and appetite? So I think that just leads us to do further research to guide our decision-making. Yeah, I think overall, it just explores other ways that we can treat nausea, vomiting rather than the usual standard treatments, because we can sometimes exhaust those. And so the strengths are looking at medications that we're currently using or readily available. But the limitations are that lonasiran is not widely available, and there's only that one limited study specifically related to nausea, vomiting. And this paper really talks a lot about other symptoms compared to what the title says, expecting more about nausea vomiting specifically, but there are other indications as well. So, and we just have to look at kind of generalizability in our palliative care context. So sorry, that's a lot in this article. So I just want to kind of open it up, and if people have comments or thoughts on that.
Thanks, Anna. So many questions about this article and these particular 3 medications. Like, how was the isopropyl alcohol delivered? Did they talk about the best way that it's used in the emerge room? Because it just actually like smelling the little pad, and how long do you hold it there for? Like, just curious.
Yeah, I think they just looked at a bunch of different ones, different articles, but I think it is that aromatherapy. And I know there was mention that some people were saying, yeah, well, you know, it might be just that the deep breathing that actually helps people with the nausea. But then someone else said, no, let's just figure this out. So they did another study And it shows that actually the isopropyl alcohol was superior to the deep breathing. So it's not that. So I think I'd have to go back because I didn't go into all of the specific articles, but I think it is just that inhalation of having it there, and it happens quite quickly. So then you could just sort of have people do this at home, or if you're in need of someone who has severe nausea, just start with that while you go and get your medicine, which we know takes time sometimes. So
any of the panelists have any thoughts, Sharon?
Yes, I've heard about this intervention, so I really appreciate getting to know more about the science of it. And I agree, it's intriguing. It has not been tested specifically in palliative care, but it's low risk. And so maybe another option while other things are initiated.
Any other thoughts from Jean or Angran?
I had a thought about this as well. You know, these are all, at least the mirtazapine, is something that's fairly commonly available that we use for other purposes. The isopropyl alcohol is commonly available. I'm wondering to what extent these have been tested against kind of our current standard of care versus placebo. Like if we're thinking about a rescue antiemetic, I think most of us think of olanzapine as one of the commonly used rescue antiemetics. Some of these have been tested against, like a head-to-head against olanzapine. And, you know, related to this, there was a study in JCO earlier this year of a oral cannabinoid extract for chemotherapy-induced nausea, vomiting. And again, I think they compared against placebo. And one of the kind of commentary on that was that, you know, it needs to also be tested against kind of current standard of care. Anna, I don't know if you had thought about this or had any comments on that.
Yeah, so you're right. And all these little studies here and there, you know, compare it to like, you know, mirtazapine against imipramine or mirtazapine with or without dexamethasone. And they all kind of were beneficial. There was that one study that did look at olanzapine and did say that it was as effective as olanzapine. But again, in I think prophylactic chemotherapy, right? Not just advanced cancer nausea. So yeah, you're right. Like, it's just sort of, we compare it. And even with the isopropyl alcohol, it's, you know, compared to dexamethasone or ondansetron, or, you know, it's better than that, but is it the best? But I think it's just neat. There are these sort of things that come up, and you can then go down these paths and try to actually do research within our population to see if they are actually beneficial.
And there's a really interesting question from Ben asking if mirtazapine is readily available for IV and can it be given sub-Q? And I don't know if you were going to answer that, Sharon. I see you unmuted.
Oh, it's not available right in a parenteral form.
Yeah, exactly. It's as far as I know as well. So that's one of the advantages of olanzapine in this case, because it can be given sub-Q or IV. All right. Well, thank you. Very interesting and lots of food for thought for future studies that we can do looking at nausea and vomiting. Thanks, Anna. So our last paper is going to be presented by Dr. Sinaraja, looking at a nurse-led brief behavioral intervention for shortness of breath in advanced lung cancer.
Thanks. And actually, if I can just finish off one of your questions, Leonie, from the last article, you wondered how is the IPA pad administered? And so I was looking at one of the Emerge articles. And so they were instructed to hold it 2.5 centimeters from their nose, and they can deep inhale for 60 seconds immediately at 2 minutes and at 4 minutes. And then they waited 10 minutes in total. And if it didn't work, then they were given systemic antiemetic. So that's how they were instructed to use. So.
Oh, thanks. I really appreciate that.
So this article I'm going to talk about is the randomized controlled trial of a nurse-led brief behavioral intervention for dyspnea in patients with advanced lung cancer. And this was published in JCO, Journal of Clinical Oncology, just this year. It's from the Boston Temel group, Greer group. So we all know that dyspnea is a very prevalent, distressing symptom in advanced lung cancer, affecting over 70% of patients. And the guidelines actually do talk about prioritizing non-pharmacological interventions as first line for dyspnea management. And so this group actually did a pilot feasibility trial of a nurse-led behavioral intervention, and it showed high acceptability and improved dyspnea. And so they went ahead with a fully randomized controlled trial running over 5.5 years. Inclusion criteria, but they had actually good functional status, so 0-2 ECOG. They were under the care of oncology. They had advanced lung or mesothelioma cancers. And they had dyspnea measured on this scale, the Modified Medical Research Council dyspnea scale of at least 2. And I have put down what 2 or more means. So for example, 2 means on level ground, I walk slower than people of my age or have to stop for breath when walking at my own pace, all the way to 4, I am too breathless to leave house or when dressing or undressing. So, you know, that applies to our population too, doesn't it? So this is a nurse-led two-session behavioral intervention, 30 to 45 minutes each. It was done in a variety of modalities where they talked about breathing techniques, postural positions, use of a handheld fan. And then the second session went into just reviewing the skills and problem solving and, you know, seeing if they have any more questions with the patient. The nurse to do this underwent the comprehensive training with the PI, Dr. Greer. He is a licensed clinical psychologist with an expertise in this. So each of the nurse underwent a training with Dr. Greer. And they did lots of great RCT like monitoring where they randomly recorded the nurse-patient interactions to make sure the fidelity was high. And then they also listened to 3 audio recordings of the sessions. And so the primary outcome was the patient reported dyspnea. They actually used 2 scales at 8 weeks. And secondary outcomes was quality of life, psychological symptoms, and activity level measured by a wrist actigraph device. And then the control group actually got the intervention 6 months later as well. So everybody eventually got the intervention. So what were the results? They approached almost 2,000 patients. In the end, they ended up with 250 patients approximately. And the results show that actually both groups improved, but the nurse-led behavioral intervention group improved more than the standard care. And there was also an improvement in the functional well-being on the FACT scale. There was no impact on the overall quality of life or psychological symptoms or the physical activity level. And then when they looked out over at 24 weeks, again, they saw continued improvement of dyspnea. So really, it looks like the nurse-led intervention that focused on behavioral techniques did improve dyspnea more than standard care. It also improved dyspnea-related functional disability and discomfort, did not impact other domains of dyspnea or secondary outcomes. And interestingly, both groups actually improved. Is it just because we know that especially nowadays, lung cancer, there are some good treatments out there now, especially if you have certain receptors, and a lot of people actually do improve with those treatments? Is there a regression to the mean that's happening? Is it that people know that they're going to eventually get the intervention at the end? And so the control group perhaps are looking forward to that as well. Very rigorous RCT design, comprehensive assessment, like I said, high intervention fidelity. Nurses addressed 95% of the intervention protocol. Limitations are that it is, again, a homogeneous sample at a, you know, high-powered tertiary academic center in Boston. There was a, you know, interestingly, a higher attrition rate in the intervention group. And so did that impact how intervention effects were detected? And it looked at functional disability. So it didn't go into, you know, psychological impacts of dyspnea and all the other implications that might come. And that might be why the overall quality of life didn't improve. And they did not systematically assess the adverse events potential. And so, you know, maybe that just wasn't documented as well. So I touched on some of these. And for me, this is important because this is a potentially scalable nurse-led behavioral intervention, but it still does take time and oncology nurses are just as busy. To me, what is more interesting as well is that they have a nice, almost 2-page table that actually goes through all the interventional techniques that was outlined in the nurse. So some of those look, you know, relatively simple. And so maybe we as part of care teams, clinicians should actually read and learn these ourselves. And so to me, that was probably one of the more interesting takeaways for this. So.
Thanks, Ayn Grand. Yeah, I also thought this study was very well done and was also intrigued like you to think about how some of our palliative care nurses or other clinicians in our team might be able to do this within our own settings and in the home and hospice. And yeah, curious to hear other thoughts about this.
Ayn Grand, I had a few thoughts as I was reading this. First, they included people with an MRC of, I think, 2 or more, but I wonder for someone with an MRC of 4, right now, would our standard of care be to suggest a non-pharmacological intervention? I don't think so. I think most of us for, you know, someone with advanced lung cancer with an MRC of 4, our standard of care would be to suggest a low-dose opioid to start if they haven't already. So I did wonder if this non-pharmacological intervention would be effective in, you know, the more severe kind of intensity of dyspnea. Another thought I had was their control group is just usual care. So is potentially some of this effect just because of the extra attention that participants are getting in those 2, you know, 30-minute sessions? Another concern was they had to approach about 2,000 participants before they actually got 250 to consent to the procedure. So this makes you wonder about how feasible it would be in real practice to get people to consent to this procedure or take this on. I agree with your thought that maybe what we can take away from this is some of these non-pharmacological interventions we can incorporate into our current practice. Our, you know, multidisciplinary team can include this as part of their practice, but I don't think this will, you know, be going head to head against an opioid for someone with MRC4 level of dyspnea. I don't know what others think.
Yeah, and maybe if I can first chime in. So just to clarify, so the 2000 people who were approached, they were administered dyspnea scale. So actually only a third of them met the inclusion criteria, which is severe dyspnea. So that's why there was such a big drop. So that, you know, drops it down to immediately about 800 people. That was probably the main reason why that occurred. And in terms of looking at other management, you're right. They didn't break it down that as far as I can see, you know, like the levels of dyspnea and whether the intervention had a differential benefit. But what is interesting, though, if you look at the appendixes eventually, is that both groups, about a third of both groups had opioids as part of their medication management. Not for dyspnea necessarily, but they had opioids on board.
We have a couple minutes if Anna or Sharon want to comment on this paper.
I don't have anything exciting to share. Just the fact that I think it is interesting that we can use non-pharmacological techniques, particularly in underserviced areas where it may be hard to access or you're waiting for something to happen and you can implement some of these interventions. And it's nice that there is a study that can kind of back that up. So thanks for sharing.
And the thing to add from my end, I agree, it's a well-designed and executed study. And there's, you know, the question of the appropriate population for this kind of intervention.
Great. Thanks, everyone. So we'd like to point out some of our honorable mention articles to you now. As we described earlier, we don't have time to go into detail on all the wonderful papers that our contributors selected. But we thought these four were worth highlighting to you and encourage you to take a look at them on your own time. So the first one is an article looking at complex advanced care planning intervention in general practice, cluster randomized control trial. The second one is looking at the surprise question, and are surprise questions and probabilistic questions by nurses useful in the home palliative care prospective study? The third one is palliative care for patients with cancer, the ASCO guideline update. And I think the last one was about 8 or 10 years ago. I can't remember the exact date. So it's definitely worth a read because it certainly guides our colleagues' oncology standards. So important for us to know about. And then the last one is looking at the risk of adverse outcomes during gabapentinoid therapy and factors associated with increased risk in primary care in the UK setting using a clinical research data link cohort study. So when you have time, I encourage you to have a look through these articles and think about some of the other interesting things that you've heard today and how you might bring these back to your teams or mull on them a little bit more. We really, really appreciate you joining us today in the spirit of continuous improvement. Thank you so much to all our Journal Watch contributors, and thank you as always to our amazing support team at Pallium, especially Diana and James. Again, have a wonderful day, everyone. Please don't forget to join us at our next session. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. I'm James O'Hearn, and I hope you found it both enjoyable and informative. If you'd like to learn more about the Journal Watch program or our other palliative care ECHO project activities, please feel free to email us at echo@pallium.ca. That's echo@pallium.ca. Or visit our website at www.echopalliative.com. The music for this episode is Dazed by Airtone. Copyright 2012, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 license. You can find Airtone's music at dig.ccmixter.org. Today's episode was produced by Diana Vince. See you soon!
Hello, I'm Jeffrey Moat, CEO of Pallium Canada. I am thrilled to invite you to join us virtually at the world's largest palliative care ECHO session on October 18th at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time. This exciting, history-in-the-making event will bring together thousands of healthcare professionals from around the globe with a panel of internationally renowned palliative care experts to explore innovative approaches and best practices in primary palliative care. Simultaneous live interpretation will be available in French, Mandarin, Hindi, Spanish, Brazilian Portuguese, and Arabic to make this a truly global experience. Don't miss your chance to be part of a global palliative care movement on October 18th. Register today at echopalliative.com. I'll see you there.